Sosa, and this is headed for people who are blind and drinking third. Hello, this is Greg Foxrock from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. The first article today is entitled The Kalinowski Regiment, and this is an edited version of the story by Ann Applebaum. To bring change to Belarus, a band of fighters is taking up arms in Ukraine. No revolutionary posters line the streets, flaming from the walls to clean, in clean reds and blues, as they did when George Orwell left Barcelona to fight in the Spanish Civil War. Gathered in a basement on a quiet tree-lined street, the Belarusians prepare to leave Warsaw to join the Ukrainian army, look more like a bunch of computer programmers getting ready for a long car trip. Maybe that's because they are a bunch of computer programmers, or anyway, some of them are, gathered in a basement on a quiet tree-lined street getting ready for a long car trip. Canned food, dried sausage, and bags of nuts and raisins are neatly stacked on the floor beside a pile of backpacks. A couple of SUVs are parked just outside. The cars have been donated by Polish or Belarusian sympathizers, or else left behind by others who have departed for the front. The group I am meeting will be leaving for the Ukrainian border in an hour, and they are speaking with me on the condition that I don't take pictures and don't ask for names. If they are identified, members of their families could be visited, harassed, even arrested by the Belarusian police. Our relatives are hostages, one of them told me. Already, mothers of Belarusian soldiers fighting in Ukraine have been forced to make public statements denouncing their children. I can tell you that they are young, in their 20s and 30s, and that they are on their way to join the Kostas Kalinowski Regiment, a military unit founded in March as part of the Ukrainian army, but with a separate Belarusian status. I can also tell you that, appearances to the contrary, they and their leaders are thoroughly grounded in the international history of armed rebellion. They know their 19th century antecedents. Kostas Kalinowski fought in the failed 1863 uprising against the Russian occupation of what was then Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. They know their 20th century antecedents, too, among them not just George Orwell in Spain, but Józef Piłsudski, a Polish general who fought with the Austrian army in 1914 because he hoped, eventually, to liberate Poland. Although Kalinowski was executed and Orwell's cause ultimately failed, Piłsudski marched his Polish legions into Warsaw. By 1918, he was the leader of independent Poland. The men in the basement are going to Ukraine because they are, like Orwell in Spain, sympathizers with another country's democratic cause, and because they hope, like Piłsudski in Poland, to eventually liberate Belarus from the dictatorship of Alexander Lukashenko, who has been in power for nearly three decades. Hope is tempered with realism. They are headed for the front line of one of the most brutal wars of the 21st century. And, bolstered by desperation, the feeling that other better roads to political change have disappeared. We didn't finish our revolution. We didn't remove Lukashenko. We didn't prevent Russian troops from crossing our border to attack Ukraine. All of these are reasons now to fight in Ukraine. A long-haired man, R, one of the computer programmers, told me that he, too, took part in the 2020 demonstration, that he, too, left Belarus afterward. But when R returned home for a visit, what he saw shocked him. People had stopped protesting. People weren't fighting. This life, he means life under the dictatorship, is enough for them. How can they just go on as if nothing is happening, as if rockets are not flying? To me, it's surreal. Kay and the others might be all roughly described as Minsk intellectuals. Their leaders, organizing papers in the next room, tell me that among the volunteers are also recent high school graduates, factory workers, ex-policemen. Some arrive in Warsaw on overnight buses from Belarus with no money and no plans other than to join the Ukrainian army. The next time I see them, or I think I see them, is a week later in a scraggly field behind a parking lot in a suburb of central Ukraine. New recruits, perhaps including some I met in Warsaw, are dressed in camouflage, carrying weapons, and in a nod to my presence, wearing balaclavas to hide their faces. Their uniforms were crowdfunded or donated by sympathizers in both Poland and Belarus. Their guns came from the Ukrainian army. Their trader is from one of the Baltic states. He is particularly valued by the Belarusians because he has passed several NATO courses, and they want to learn to fight like NATO soldiers. One of the many ironies of the current moment is how many opponents of Putin's Russia, from the Baltic to the Black Sea, and indeed all the way to central Russia, share Russian as a common language and can use it to organize, even to teach American military doctrine across national lines. I watch them with Rokosh, the alias of a man who has been part of different Belarusian democracy movements since the 1990s. He explains that today's exercises involve training to fight in cities. On other days, they go to the Ukrainian army's shooting ranges or practice trench warfare. The field has been dug up for that purpose. They follow a strict schedule: morning exercise, all-day training, films or lectures in the evenings, and live together in a rundown dormitory nearby. The people's right to revolt is justified because all civilized methods of changing the situation were exhausted, one said. Even so, the Russian invasion of Ukraine was a turning point, a different level of threat, a shock to the system, a, quote, spit in the face. If Ukraine does not win, one of them told me, we will have to say goodbye to any idea of a free Belarus. The members of the Kalinowski regiment are motivated by a belief that the Belarusian regime is both much weaker and much more dangerous than many assume. Lukashenko, they argue, is deeply unpopular. They reckon that no more than 10 to 20% of the population supports him, mostly pensioners, bureaucrats, and security service employees who depend on the state for jobs in a failing economy. And he knows this. Lukashenko has no ideology, but he will do anything to stay in power. That means when Russian President Vladimir Putin threatens, as he did at the end of June, to transfer nuclear missiles to Belarus, the world should pay attention. Putin might want to avoid the geopolitical consequences of using nuclear weapons for the first time since 1945. But Lukashenko might not care. The Kalinowski fighters think Belarus has another kind of significance, too. After all, if the Russian leader wants to reunite Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine into some kind of neo-Soviet empire, Lukashenko's loyalty is a necessary ingredient. But what if the Belarusian pillar disappears? Then everything else, the empire, the war with Ukraine, Putinism itself, might crumble as well. This, they want the world to know, is an opportunity that should be taken, not least because, as one of them put it, Lukashenko is easier to unseat than Putin. Right now, nobody other than the Poles, and of course the Ukrainians, is assisting the Kalinowski fighters. But maybe someday others will. Rokosh tells me that he wants the fighters eventually to get access to better Western and NATO intelligence about what goes on inside their country so they can better plan their next steps. They believe that if they can lean hard on the scales of history and help the Ukrainians win, then both Russia and its Belarusian satrap will be far weaker. They could pay a high price, not just with their time and effort, but with their lives. On January 26, the commander of one of the Belarusian battalions died during the battle for Lysychansk. Ivan Marchuk, alias Brest, was 28. Others also have been killed, wounded, or captured. But if they don't fight, they might pay another kind of price. If Ukraine loses and Russia is empowered, then Belarus will remain a dictatorship, and they will never be able to go home. Those of us who live in luckier countries with better geography don't know what it feels like to have a choice between fighting and exile, but all of the people sweating in this field truly do. Back in Warsaw, one of the volunteers told me that since leaving his country in 2020, he had done nothing but move from place to place, trying to make a different life, but never really finding a home. Belarus is his only home, but before he can return there, he has to help change it. And I run, and run, and I run. I would like to stop running. That story was from the October 2022 issue of The Atlantic. Next, we will hear a story from the December 2022 issue entitled The Petulant King. Charles III Can't Keep the Myth of the Monarchy Alive by Caitlin Flanagan. A difficult labor, 30 hours, and someone has to make the terrible decision. Right there in a Buckingham Palace bedroom with mother and child etherized upon the table, deft hands make the cut. The unwilling baby is tugged out, and it's done. A boy, clever girl. To sleep, to sleep, to sleep. Posted on the gates of the palace, a handwritten announcement. Her Royal Highness, the Princess Elizabeth, Duchess of Edinburgh, was safely delivered of a prince at 9:14 o'clock this evening. Her Royal Highness and the infant prince are both well. They are both children of empire, princess and prince, though they lie there recovering, as they lie there recovering, that empire is receding, the long, melancholy withdrawing roar audible even above the cheers of the crowds outside the palace. They have been chosen for the same fate, but only one at a time can live it out. This will at once draw them together and complicate what will be a strange and mutually disappointing relationship. In just 3 years, Elizabeth will become the 25-year-old Queen of the United Kingdom, but Charles won't be king until he's 73. What must it be like to watch yourself fade into a middle-aged man and then an old one, but still your life's work has not begun? He is only hours old, and at the very start of the world's longest apprenticeship. When he finally became king in September, not even a week passed before the tabloids were talking about his poor hands looking as red as lobster claws, perhaps because never before had so many people wanted to shake them. Things were not going perfectly, but they were going well. There was a handshaking, undertaking, however painfully, with his mother's famous commitment to duty, and there was the first speech to the people, with him sitting in Buckingham Palace, doling out sinecures to all the good little kittens, Queen Consort for Camellia, Princess of Wales for well-behaved Kate, Sweet Nothing for Meghan, who had dragged Harry off to the non-realm of California. Had he struck the right note when he referred to the late queen as, quote, my darling mama, rather than my mother? Everything he waited so long to do was happening so quickly. But it was during a hop to Northern Ireland that the wheels came off the carriage and Charles lost his cool. While signing the visitor's book at Hillsborough Castle, he wrote down the wrong date, and was quietly informed by Camilla that the pen was leaking, and seethed. I can't bear this bloody thing, every stinking time. There was something a little Fawlty Towers about the scene, and it gestured toward the fact that the English monarchy seemed to be downsizing. Charles' mother had survived the Battle of Britain. He couldn't survive a guest book. But we're ahead of ourselves. It's Elizabeth who's got to get out of that birthing bed and take the first shaky steps down the long corridors. The health of her father, George VI, is failing. Already she has been performing some of his duties. Once she takes the throne, she'll head off on many, many royal tours, some months long, leaving Charles, who will spend his childhood pining for her, behind. During the first half of her reign, Elizabeth will preside, in her wholly symbolic yet powerful way, over the final dismantling of the empire. She will be the last face of a centuries-long fiction of ownership, in which human beings, gold, precious gems, rubber, anything that could be chained up, prized from the earth, grabbed from villages and palaces, or literally cut out of rock, was transformed into property of the British Empire or its NGO, the unfathomably brutal East India Company. Everything you saw at the Queen's funeral, the sheer size of the regiments, their ornamental uniforms, the perfection of their marching, all of it so unbelievably out of step with modern cash-strapped Britain, was a proud reminder of the days when Britain was the most powerful nation in the world, a place that could be hyped up in pubs and snooker halls, the way football teams are now. Rule Britannia, Britannia rule the waves. Britons never, never, never will be slaves. Consider the Queen's, now the King's, scepter, which figured so prominently in the service. What is that massive, glittering, unreal-seeming jewel at the top? The Great Star of Africa, one of many diamonds relocated from South Africa to the Crown's vast holdings. You would assume that Elizabeth would be despised in Britain's former colonies. She was, after all, the great-great-granddaughter of Queen Victoria, the first Empress of India. But Elizabeth was admired by millions of people in many of those former colonies, from the earliest days of her reign to the hour of her death. Even now, when we view so much of a world history through the lens of colonization and its devastations, the Queen is mourned. Queen Elizabeth II was formal, interested, uncomplaining, and always respectful. Her warehouses worth of matching coats and whimsical hats were an aspect of that respect. It didn't matter if she had arrived for your tour, for a tour of your rat extermination business in Manchester. She was dressed as if attending a new exhibit at the National Gallery. She seemed to understand that her fate and that of the rat exterminators were deeply bound together, which they were. She didn't really serve at the pleasure of God and the House of Windsor. She served at the pleasure of the exterminators and the takeaway shop owners and the Daily Mail. Once the sun had set on the British Empire, the Queen began her much more complicated mission, which was forming a coherent narrative of England and Englishness in the face of the Great Disruptor. 25 years of massive immigration. In 1997, Prime Minister Tony Blair began relaxing immigration laws in hope of creating an England imbued with the best traditions of a range of cultures, an England that was no longer fortified against the world but wide open to it, an oasis of people eating fusion cuisine and voting labor. In a way, it sort of worked, as in any episode of the Great British Bake Off attests. To watch contestants from every racial, ethnic, and religious background tell the hosts the secret ingredient in me grand sponge, from inside a giant white tent pitched on the green lawns of a country house in Berkshire, is to see England smacked down to a set of consumer preferences. Emma Bridgewater, strings of fluttering Union Jacks, cake. But the old lessons of the empire were not lost on newcomers, a few of whom brought to England the same thing that England had once brought them, contemptuous disregard of the religion, customs, habits, traditions, and shared beliefs of the native population. And that's how you get Sharia councils in modern England. It fell to Elizabeth, older daughter of a man who never wanted or expected to be king, a woman with many interests of her own that she would much rather have pursued, to try to maintain the fantasy of a continuous England that could absorb within it wildly different cultures. What she relied upon was the West. The Englishmen who caused so much devastation around the world did not bring any miracles with them. They only brought bloodshed and cruelty and plunder, the same forces that had ruled the world since the beginning. But by the time of Elizabeth's reign, England understood itself as a Western country, identifiable by its commitment to individual rights, equality, and self-determination. These values created the free world, and to the very limited extent that a queen can stand for them, the queen of a country with such a terrible imperial history, she was determined to do so. Elizabeth never celebrated multiculturalism in the smarmy, meaningless way that college presidents or HR functionaries, but she often acknowledged how Britain was changing, never once disparaging it, and found within a plausible case for continuity. What she did was locate, or possibly create, a unifying culture of Englishness as defined by the values of the Blitz: courage, calm, resolve. Here she is just a couple of years ago, at age 93, giving a televised address about COVID-19. I want to reassure you that if we remain united and resolute, then we will overcome it. I hope in the years to come everyone will be able to take pride in how they responded to this challenge. And those who come after us will say the Britons of this generation were as strong as any, that the attributes of self-discipline, of quiet, good-humored resolve, and of fellow feeling still characterizes this country. The pride in who we are is not a part of our past. It defines our present and our future. It was COVID, not war. She was just asking her servants, her subjects, to wear a mask and watch the telly, but it sounded like a call to greatness. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, while any speaks, they that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. It was COVID, but it was also the Battle of Britain and Agincourt and all of it. And now this whole delicate operation of creating a Britain in which the old and the new don't merely coexist, but inform each other, but are together part of a cohesive narrative of greatness, in which the monarch is both the defender of the Church of England and the symbolic leader of a country with 3 million Muslims. All of this has fallen to Charles, weak, selfish, petulant Charles. Only in fairy tales does it make sense to weep for a prince. That said, Charles' early years were sorrowful. He longed to be with his mother, but she was often away. One newsreel of a little boy captured him immaculately dressed, standing trustingly at his grandmother's side, looking anxiously down a train platform for any sign of his approaching mother. Once there, Elizabeth greeted her mother, and then, as an afterthought almost, bent down neatly, pressed a light kiss on her child's head, and went on about her ceremonial duties. Charles stared up at her in a bemused way, as though months-long dream of mother had not really suggested this slender, preoccupied adult. A word so often applied to Charles in his early years, you might have assumed was a code word for gay, which he was not, was sensitive. There is nothing his ghastly father wanted less than a sensitive son, which only redoubled his certainty that Charles had to attend Prince Philip's own brutal make-a-man-of-you Scottish boarding school, Gordonstoun, from which Charles begged to be rescued, and where he complained of serious bullying. What does bullying mean in the context of a mid-century Scottish all-male boarding school? It means, I would imagine, that it was a traumatic experience in a variety of ways. Charles did the required military duty, tangling his legs in the rigging of his first parachuting exercise, getting seasick on naval ships, and banging his head on low doorways below decks. And after that, the long, long wait, filled with the eccentric preoccupations of the country gentleman. The aspect of Charles' character that makes him particularly unsuited to being king is that he's weak. How many men in the history of the world have managed to have a wife and a mistress without damn near burning down civilization? In his first address to the nation, he sounded less like he was assuming the throne of England than he was throwing his hat into the Pennsylvania Senate race. He promised to respect people no matter their heritage and beliefs, and to uphold constitutional principles. More than anything, what Elizabeth was able to do for an astonishing 70 years that her feckless son will not be able to do was prevent a very large bill from coming due. She was allowed to keep the great Star of Africa and the palaces and the untold billions of pounds because she was Elizabeth, But make no mistake, Charles has been handed an England in which a growing percentage of the population has no inclination to continue making nice with the crown. After the radical justice protests, racial justice protests of 2020, statues of English slavers were taken down, one famously stomped by a mob. This is not an era of reconciliation and bygones being bygones. This is an era of reparations. A lot of people around the world don't want to celebrate diversity, a concept wholly born of the dying West. They want the treasures back, and they know where to find them. Most of them were stolen, and in the most sadistic way possible. Will Charles, Boomer Zero, be able to keep hold not merely of the things, but of the idea of England that his mother helped create? Doubtful. Now from the November 2022 issue. I fixed my insomnia with whiskey and audiobooks. An Ode to Being Read To by James Parker. Seriously, I was a terrible non-sleeper once upon a time. In the small hours, in the little pointy hours, wife asleep, son asleep, dog asleep, when the whole apartment seemed to creak and bulge like a vessel rigged for oblivion, I would creep onto the couch and torture myself with last man in the worldness. But then I discovered it. I synthesized it. Jameson, headphones, the antidote, the warming, blurring the edges whiskey, a shot or two, no more, and the human voice. First it was John le Carré novels, English voices murmuring about espionage, to a boarding school boy like me, a cracked product of the establishment, intensely soothing. Then it was Linda Hamilton, yes, Linda Hamilton of Terminator, reading Martin Amis's Night Train. Michael Cochran reading Evelyn Waugh's The Ordeal of Gilbert Pinfold, a performance of extraordinary Pinfoldian energy. When Cochran enunciated the word parliamentary, it has six syllables. And John Moffat reading Spencer's The Faerie Queen. Believe me, nothing lays you out like The Faerie Queen. I don't think I've ever made it to the second canto. It's very late-stage capitalism, of course, to sit there or lie there in your envelope of sound, your private entertainment capsule, technologically sealed and cerebrally catered to, fiddling with the volume. But being read to is ancient. I love a podcast, the chit-chat, the colloquially. But this is deeper. The reading voice, the singular storytelling voice, thrums in the memory tunnels of the species. When I'm listening to an audiobook, I'm entertained like a tired plowman. I'm being lulled, bardically lulled, like a drunken baron at a long feast table, pork grease shining on my chin. I'm being quieted like a child. I'm being spellbound like a face caught in firelight. And if you're prone and comfortable and perhaps a little buzzed, you'll sleep. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.